I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode. I'm Brandon Sedloff, Managing Director at Juniper Square, and you're listening to The Distribution by Juniper Square. On today's episode, I sit down with the fifth largest owner of real estate in the world, Carly Tripp, the global CIO of Nuveen Real Estate. In addition to talking about the size and scale of their portfolio, we talk about the trends that Carly's seeing in mixed-use development, as well as the importance of staying ahead of what's happening in technology. Let's get into it. Carly, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here, Brandon. Thanks for having me.
So you've been at Nuveen for almost 18 years, I understand, this June. Tell me a little bit about what got you interested in real estate and talk to us a little bit about your journey at Nuveen so far.
Yeah, sure. You know, thanks for the reminder. 18 years really rolls off the tongue. It's pretty startling when you think of how quickly time goes by. So looking back, I've been in the industry for about 20 years. I started my career at LaSalle Investment Management in Baltimore. And I was kind of one of these early movers to the Southeast. So the migration that we've seen over the last decade, I was very, very early on. And the genesis for that was I was looking to buy a home after graduating from undergrad. And it was during the housing bubble in 2006. And home costs were prohibitive for me as a young person in the DC area, right? And so as we started kind of looking around, well, where can you get a good job, find affordable housing, and then also have warmer weather, settled on Charlotte. So I think that's just like an important landing point on where my career really began. But even rewinding before that and why I got into real estate to begin with, as I mentioned, I went to University of Maryland undergrad. They did not have any real estate courses in their business school, but I was really, really interested in the asset class. And the reason for that is because I grew up in a really small town called Olney, Maryland. It's in Montgomery County, Maryland, a bedroom community of DC. About 12 miles as the crow flies from DC with traffic. It's like an hour and a half. It takes forever to get there. When I was young, I played in cornfields, right? There was nothing there. It truly was just this small town. By the time I graduated high school, there were like, you know, five grocers within a mile. It became a very master plan community, popular place to live, easy access to transportation, all of the things. And as my parents started considering retirement, and at this time I was well into undergrad, I became really, really curious on how much they were selling their home for versus how much they bought it for. I just wanted to know. I was studying finance at the time. And so I found that interesting. I also found it interesting just the amount of development in the community and what that really kind of did for the community and how it benefited the community and the school systems in particular. Very, very diverse community as well, which got me interested. So I did a stint over one summer in undergrad at Berkeley. Berkeley has an excellent real estate program in the Haas School of Business. And I took a course there from a professor, Dennis Williams, who It was historically a very prolific lender at Northmark. Some of you may remember Dennis. And he taught an excellent course. It was really challenging, but we went to visit, you know, various buildings in San Francisco, the Ferry Building. And it was an investment that we could actually like see and feel and understand, you know, especially as a female and a consumer. And at the time, the target consumer, I could really, really kind of understand it. And I could, you know, also, I think, relate, right? As a young person who wanted to find work in an office building, who wanted to shop in a retail center, and then of course, like wanted to think about where I wanted to live. And so I did that course. I started focusing on being recruited to commercial real estate within the industry. And of course, went to LaSalle, as I mentioned, right out of undergrad, did their rotational analyst program. It was a great, great, great experience. Had an amazing manager kind of teaching me the ropes early on. And when I moved to Charlotte, I started off in valuations, actually. I was on the valuation team, which, you know, look, in 2006, 7, 8, wasn't that interesting. Valuations directionally were going in the right place. So I was responsible for valuing the equity and debt in TIA's general account portfolio. And when things are on the up and up, you know, it's sort of, I guess, a non-issue, so to speak. However, after 2008 hit, it became really, really interesting. And everyone in the company wanted to know exactly what you were doing because you were responsible for then calculating the losses. And so I think living through the financial crisis and being in a position where I was responsible for valuations was just like experience that was invaluable. And so I started to kind of build from there, eventually moving over to front office. I was an asset manager responsible for all sectors across the state of Florida. Love that. Gave me kind of a flavor of, you know, managing external teams, as well as negotiating leases and all of that fun stuff. But I really, really enjoyed the strategic aspect of the business. Mostly, I enjoyed the numbers as well. So I moved on to portfolio management eventually and spent 5 years managing the TIAA real estate account, which is a very large $30 billion diversified fund that gives investors, individual investors, access to commercial real estate, institutional quality commercial real estate, of course, with full liquidity. So it's unique in that regard and unlike really any product out there. So that was a great experience coming out of the financial crisis because we had the reverse problem that then you were being, you know, you had a lot of cash to manage. And cash management became challenging coming out of a cycle where the asset class was in very, very high demand and folks were just starting to transact again. So fast forward a few years, I did a stint where I covered all real assets for the general account as well. So that was more kind of akin to an LP role, but it gave me a broader view outside of commercial real estate, which I really, really enjoyed. I got to cover private equity, infrastructure, ag, timber, any kind of thing that was equity within a $300 billion general account, I had my hands on. And so it gave me a very, very good, I think, high level view of various asset classes. And then I came back over as USIO to the real estate business in 2019. Having had that experience, I still really, really loved real estate. And so I was excited to come back. And that is it in a nutshell.
And now just to bring it full circle, you're global CIO and head of investments, if I'm not mistaken?
Correct.
What does a global CIO inside of Nuveen Real Estate do? How would you describe your job?
Yeah, I think jack of all trades is how I would describe my job. And I think other CIOs can probably relate to that. So, you know, first and foremost, the direct team that I manage and oversee is responsible for all execution functions. So all transactions and asset management. So in terms of just the day-to-day and direct oversight from a leadership perspective, that is what the team is responsible for. Also, we're organized into sectors. So we do not have a generalist model at Nuveen Real Estate. We have a sector-specific model. So each sector has a very distinct business that is led by a global sector head. And really, the intention there is to have an investment team that just eats, sleeps, breathes one market day in and day out. We think we can kind of effectuate much better experience and ultimately returns for our clients that way. And so that's the predominant part of my responsibilities. However, as you can imagine, there's all kinds of other things going on within the business and a lot of other activities going on because we exist inside of $1 trillion asset management, you know, vis-a-vis Nuveen. And so whether it's corporate responsibilities, internal stakeholder engagement, external engagement with the market, investor meetings, and we do manage, you know, institutional and retail products as well, or just planning and plotting our future, right? Our strategic objectives, where our compass should be pointed, high conviction ideas, working with the research team, kind of all of those things I do get involved in as well. So it's really, really fun. I love my job.
Sounds vast. I'm sure we'll continue to unpack a few of the specific areas. But as you look back on the time at Nuveen, you know, are there any kind of periods you mentioned, you know, your stint doing valuations, obviously asset management, portfolio management, you've done a lot. So while it's a long amount of time at one place, it sounds like the role has been continuously evolving or your development has been continuously evolving. Is there anything that you look back to say, like, this was these were the experiences, this was the role that really helped kind of me become more confident as a leader in real estate or set me up to be the global CIO of a large real estate business? Anything stand out in particular?
Yeah, I think my time in portfolio management. So as I mentioned, you know, I was working on a fund that was really, really unique, right? It was large, it had retail investors, and we provided daily liquidity. So when the fund was first constructed in the mid-90s, it was a requirement that TIAA backstop liquidity. And that's how we were going to give our investors access to institutional real estate. So it was really, really kind of unique, I think, at the time. That fund, as a result, you know, you have different levers to pull. So obviously, traditional, when should you buy, when should you sell, what should you buy, what should you sell, but also how much leverage to put on. When you're getting in about $300 million a month in capital flows, which we were coming out of the financial crisis, you know, obviously selling, leveraging, all of those things become very, very discreet decisions. In addition, there's a cash component that's required that's invested in corporate bonds. There is also a liquidity requirement that is invested in public REITs, and we can invest in commercial mortgages, as well as, of course, equity, which is, you know, the lion's share of the fund. So I think that just provided a really, really good view of the industry at large, so to speak, public and private, equity versus debt, managing liquidity, cash management, what to buy, where to buy it. You're working with teams, you know, of acquisition professionals on a national basis, doing budgets, planning capital projects. So it was just like, you know, all hands on deck. You got to see everything. And you got to see it in a very intense way coming out of the financial crisis. So it was also just, you know, I think related to the timing when I had those responsibilities as well. It just became really, really interesting. And it was really, really fun. I like problem solving. And I think a lot of my responsibilities, you know, today are around problem solving. And so that was just, you know, again, invaluable experience at the time.
So speaking of solving problems, I think we're recording this in March of 2024. And the world is slightly more certain today, but there's still a lot of uncertainty out there. What are kind of some of the problems that are top of mind for you as you look at kind of the global landscape and you look at the markets and you look at your own business that you're leading? Kind of what are your kind of top two or three priorities, or you know, maybe problems is the wrong way to phrase it, but areas of focus for you today?
We have a lot of variation in what we do, right? We're equity owners, and then we're also large lenders as well. So get to kind of see current landscapes on both sides of the house. We are the fifth largest owner of commercial real estate globally. So we have a very, very, you know, dense book also globally. And so I would say, you know, obviously there's opportunities today, there's challenges as well. Where we're focused today is just looking at the future and what the future means to real estate. So I think, you know, we transitioned our business and our diversified funds around 7 or 8 years ago to be focused and overweight to alternatives to housing, to industrial, which doesn't sound different in recent years, but I do believe we were ahead of the curve there. And that was really data driven. We have not invested in traditional office since well before COVID. We've been net sellers of office since well before COVID. And so I think we saw the landscape and sort of the data directionally telling us where to invest. Now that's changing going forward, right? Well, sector allocations, I think, pushed alpha for sure over the last 5 years. I think the spread there and the disparity is going to get a little thinner. And so you have to look to what is going to be the winner, so to speak, over the next 10 years. You know, I love the example. Everyone's talking about AI now. I do not pretend to be an AI expert or a techie by any means. But if you look at how it's affecting our industry, OpenAI's, you know, release of Sora is going to be massively impactful for studio space, right? And so ensuring that we have the best minds looking as deeply at data and what is going on currently in the environment is so important. And then I think also leveraging the scale and size and power of Nuveen's platform in that we have a huge just public equity business. We have a really, really large bond business and experts within those that also are looking at a different set of data and can help sort of guide us information going forward that is relevant to how we invest in real estate. So again, it's just navigating, you know, what does the next 10 years look like compared to the past 10? Always with an eye on, you know, provoking the best results for our clients.
So there's a few different areas that my mind is kind of taking me in that I want to go, but let's start with kind of data. Curious to know, what was it that led you to kind of rotate out of office pre-COVID using data and start to look at, you know, housing and industrial? Was there specific trends that you saw at the time, or kind of what helped create that thesis back before COVID even happened?
Yeah, I think it was a number of things. I think, you know, number one is that office is big, right? They were large ticket sizes. And we wanted to create diversified portfolios and minimize idiosyncratic risk. And that was really kind of the result of lessons learned during the financial crisis and after. And then also just being able to better control your operations and your returns. And so one is just like the size and scale. So single asset risk exposure in office buildings became just, you know, undesirable. I think second to that is that they're incredibly capital intensive. They cost a lot of money to maintain. They cost a lot of money to transition. And then we also saw this trend of, you know, tenants wanting shorter term leases, which meant more capital improvements. Large tenant users, quote, enterprise users can be great, but they can also hold you hostage on a negotiation if you're overexposed. And so not only did you have kind of limited diversification because of single asset risk, but within the building, you have limited diversification in terms of tenancy. And so we really kind of started shifting our focus to more niche office uses such as medical, some creative, and smaller offices located in high growth markets that are kind of, you know, more new economy, less costly to transition, have newer systems, can incorporate new technology, right? And aren't at risk for a transitioning landscape, either technologically or from like a sustainability perspective or whatever it is.
Yeah, that makes sense. Before we go too far into the specific asset classes that you like and maybe some of those that you don't, what is the footprint? You mentioned Nuveen's the fifth largest owner of commercial real estate globally. What does that footprint look like from a asset and geography allocation perspective at a 30,000 foot level?
Yeah, it's majority US. So the proportion of AUM in our US business is around 65%, 25% across Europe, and then only 5% in Asia Pac. So it's predominantly across, you know, pan-European markets and then also the US. However, we do have 30 offices globally, which I think is unique and distinct. We have 11 offices in the US alone. We think not only a sector model is really, really important, but a local model is also as important. And so I think that is unique as, you know, you could make an argument that you have managed the US from one West Coast office and an East Coast office, Europe maybe from London, and then Asia Pac, either Hong Kong or Singapore, right? But we really wanted to have direct access and control to the networks of real estate, you know, not only investors, but managers, developers within the markets that we're interested in investing in. And then not only that, my boss always uses this analogy. He loves food analogies. You've probably met Chris. He's a big foodie. But, you know, he always says, look, if I'm going to travel like to LA, I'm not going to ask somebody in New York where to eat and where to stay. I'm going to ask someone in LA where to eat and where to stay. And so it sounds really, really simple. But at the end of the day, I think real estate investing is local. And we try and increase results through direct operations, right? Through adding value by knowing how to position a building within its local market. And so that's super important for us as well.
In the AUM of the real estate business, what does that stand at today, approximately?
It's about $150
billion. $150 billion. Okay. And how has that changed over time for real estate? I'm assuming it's significantly increased, but kind of help us understand maybe what was that 15, 20 years ago when you were just getting started?
Yeah. It's transitioned quite a bit. A lot of inorganic growth and then organic growth as well. But I guess I would take it back to the purchase, well, two major acquisitions that TIAA made, right? And this was all in the spirit of diversifying TIAA's revenue base to third parties. Because TIAA is a large provider in the 403B space. And the CEO at the time felt it was really necessary to own a large asset manager to diversify its revenue stream. And so two large purchases, one of course was Nuveen. Nuveen is a, you know, prolific municipal bond originator out of Chicago. John Nuveen, you know, is thought to be, you know, the grandfather or the originator of the municipal bond. And so that was an interesting, you know, obviously business to buy, and it came along with a lot of ancillary business as well. On the equity side, there was not a real estate business, but there was a public REIT business. And so we started looking to diversify our real estate business, not only to more, you know, geared more toward third party management, but globally expand our footprint as well. And so TIA purchased Henderson Global Investors around the same time as Nuveen, and this all occurred about 9 years ago. Henderson Global Investors, huge footprint across Europe, some sprinklings across Asia as well, and was 100% a third-party investment manager versus TIAA, which was obviously mostly a balance sheet investor. So it was kind of very, you know, perfect marriage, I think, if you will, to expand the business. And since then, it's really kind of transitioned to Nuveen having a very arm's length relationship, obviously, with TIAA. We consider TIAA our client. So they are an important aspect of Nuveen. They're also, you know, the owner of Nuveen. And how it's transitioned is much more into a commercialized business versus an insurance investor. This has all occurred, you know, over the last 10 years. and how we've grown the business. Again, I mentioned the inorganic growth through M&A. We've since done a little bit more M&A in high conviction sectors, but more so we realigned our business, I think I mentioned at the onset, into sector businesses. So we did a lot of new recruiting, very, very, very talented individuals whose history and careers had been focused on, you know, distinct and specific sectors, and kind of transitioned through, I think, that vision, right, of being able to provide really unique expertise, but also institutional expertise to third parties, you know, vis-a-vis the sector model. So a lot of heavy recruiting and growth that way.
On the recruiting front, I'm always curious. I think I've been in the business about 20 years as well. And one of the things I've observed is this barbell. You've got senior people who have a lot of institutional knowledge, a lot of sector experience, who are kind of at the stage in their career where they're exiting the business. And maybe senior is the wrong word, but long tenured folks. And then you've got people who want to enter the business. You mentioned something earlier about kind of the best minds and data and technology. I'm wondering, from a recruiting perspective, has anything changed in terms of how you're seeking to either find or grow talent inside of Nuveen, given kind of the ever-changing dynamics of the broader market around us?
Yeah, I think it's always changing. You know, one is DEI is really, really important to us. So when we're out there recruiting and interviewing, we have a requirement that we really go deep in screening and gathering candidates. And so that's, I think, important. You have to consider folks who may be making a career change or maybe didn't study real estate in college specifically, and just be open-minded about who, you know, just entry level, I think, you're bringing into the business. At the same time, as I mentioned, we kind of became very data-driven. This was 7 or 8 years ago. And as an example, we hired a data scientist from Green Street, right, to come work on our research team. And that same person is, you know, working directly for me now, has gone through the investment team and had a number of different roles since then, but proved incredibly capable and highly resourceful and is reporting directly to me and is kind of like my right hand at this point. And so I think you have to be open-minded about who is going to add value into your future perspective. And so I mentioned earlier, you know, knowing what real estate's going to look like over the next 10 years. And I like how you laid it out, Brandon, in terms of like you have the senior folks who have the institutional knowledge and been around really, really long. And then how do you pair them? I think that's really different than how commercial real estate operated, you know, 10, 20 years ago, for sure. If you've been in the industry, you've seen it, right? And so leading our US retail team is a woman named Katie Grissom. She is the target consumer, right? She knows what's cool in retail because she is the target consumer. And so having that level of expertise is really important. I always, you know, say to folks, look, I don't know what's going to be cool in 10 years. I do not know what's going to be cool in 10 years. I'm not young enough to know like how tech is going to really, really change the world. If I want to know what's cool, I ask my kids, right? Like, what do you see the world looking like in 10 years? And then the folks who are more seasoned, have been around longer, are just here really to kind of encourage, empower, but also ensure that, you know, they don't make mistakes after us having lived through, you know, the financial crisis and all kinds of cycles. And obviously, as you know, on a deal by deal basis, you know, looking back and hindsight's always 20/20. And so it's really like we're here as a guide, right? Versus instructing the business to do what we think, you know, necessarily it should do. So we gain a lot of insight from just listening to people and listening to people globally across the board, because there's also, I think, different insights to glean culturally if you're investing in a global business as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's fascinating. You can learn a lot by listening. I like to talk a lot about that. So let's talk about the market. So as you look globally, I know the lion's share of your investments are in North America. What do you see as you kind of compare and contrast the different regions, let's call it APAC, Europe, North America. What are some of the kind of core drivers that you're seeing in each of those regions? And then we can bring it back to focus the conversation mostly on the US once we get the global orientation.
Yeah, perfect. So, you know, as we sit here today, right, the US seemingly is coming out of, and you can't even really call it a cycle because we did not go into a technical recession. But I would say the policy cycle, the hiking cycle, that brewed a lot of uncertainty in the market because we were first to act on policy, right? We were very, very aggressive from a policy standpoint and kind of thought all along as a result, we would bring in inflation, kind of control that end of the macro environment a little bit more quickly than our international friends. And then, of course, our international friends are dealing with some geopolitical issues that aren't necessarily impacting us as directly. Looking across Europe, of course, you know, the UK, you do have been a technical recession. Some poor European countries contracting as well, albeit pretty modestly, right? I don't think they're so impacted that it's going to be, you know, a severe cycle for Europe at all. And then Asia Pac has been incredibly resilient. Inflation didn't hit necessarily as hard. Employment, like the US, remains strong. Of course, there's variation across markets. But all in all, you know, real estate returns declined a fraction of what they did in the US and Europe, which is, you know, effectively 20% peak to trough. And so I think, you know, it's definitely screaming for diversification and why you have diversification. You, of course, had the currency aspect as well and a really, really strong dollar, another reason for diversification. And if you look across just culturally, consumer behavior, all of those fun things, like how do people live, work, play on a daily basis, there's variations as well. So, you know, you go to Tokyo, you go to Seoul, Singapore, the office markets are incredibly strong, right? Vacancies of less than 5%, vastly, vastly different than the US. Europe, utilization of office is much stronger than the US as well. So return to office culturally across Europe, you have to be really in the office. And that was, they were early movers in that, where the US were really kind of struggling to get folks back. And so you have a lot of variation, I think, across sectors in how people just live and work and play. And then you also obviously have the macroeconomic dynamics that impact, you know, currency, interest rates, inflation, policy, demand, supply considerations, all of these things as well across regions. So again, you know, what you glean from that ultimately is diversification is really, really important.
So that brings us to the US. As you think about, you know, diversification, and you also think about the things, you know, you said, you know, you don't know what's going to be cool in 10 years, but if you listen, you know, you can kind of effectively guide the business. What are some of the kind of sectors or geographies inside of the US that you're leaning into where you think there's some strong kind of tailwinds over the coming decade?
Yeah, I think number one I would mention is affordable housing. I think that we lack affordable options across the US. And by affordable, I really mean 60% and below of AMI. However, there's really strong government support at the federal and the state and local levels. And it's really kind of refined and mature. And so that enables institutional investors to invest in these communities, which is a positive thing, right? It should not be ever, I think, voice is a negative aspect of investing as well. If you look at communities, residents that do well are the residents that live in communities where there is a lot of public and private investment. It's really, really simple. And so if you deter institutional capital from investing in these communities, then you're really, really hurting the residents' opportunity and optionality going forward. So that is something that we feel strongly convicted on, not only from an investment perspective, but from an impact perspective as well. So we really like the space. We made an acquisition that we closed in May. And so we are now the largest owner operator of affordable housing in the US. So clearly highly convicted on that.
tell me a little bit more. I mean, what does that look like to you in terms of government participation or cooperation? You mentioned that there's some, I think, some incentives, or there's a lot of proof that when public and private capital interacts, it creates good outcomes. But are there like markets that you, is this a federal, do you look at this from a federal level, from a local and regional state level? How do you think about that? Because I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, look, it's very nuanced. And so you look at it at a federal level, just from HUD sponsored programs and support, and also ongoing monitoring. So that's really important. And then you look at it at a state level in terms of how many dollars, right, in tax incentives or bond financing is the state offering in support of affordable housing? And you kind of go from there. From there, you know, whether it's going to take a long time to develop or to develop quickly, a long time to get approved, et cetera. But in all cases, again, these programs are really well constructed, mature at this point in time, and necessary. And I think, you know, capital, hopefully from a policy perspective, will continue, because this is clearly a very glaring problem that we have in the country. So I wouldn't say, you know, from a policy perspective or a regulatory perspective, it's, you know, quote, hard. I just think institutional investors have been disincentivized, you know, due to potentially perceived headline risk, which again, residents who do well are those who live inside of communities that get public and private investment around it.
What's the scale of the portfolio, the platform that you acquired to make you the largest owner of affordable in the country?
Currently, we own in total around $7 billion of affordable housing across the country. And that is truly affordable. We obviously have a lot more exposure to housing overall. We're a top 10 owner of housing, and just within market rate housing, we do have a lot of naturally occurring affordable too within that portfolio. So that's exclusive of that. Yeah, the second one I'll mention, and this is just like on the heels of this whole like regional diversification and the reason we need it, mixed use, I think, is really, really interesting, right? And there's different ways to do mixed use. I mentioned before limiting single asset exposure and risk, but there are smaller ways to do mixed use and do it well. And so when you think about diversification, if you have a mixed use project, you have exposure to housing, exposure to retail, exposure to office, hopefully that's limited today, but really kind of if it's, I think, retail led, you've created diversification within one single project. And on any given day, any given time, retail may be performing better than the housing and vice versa, right? So you've created kind of an ecosystem in which diversification exists directly. And when we look to mixed use, I think long-term trends is, you know, people are going to want to walk more and more, right? Driving cars, you know, I don't think getting in your car to commute an hour is going to be, you know, the future of how we live. I think when we think about modernizing our society, it will be much more sort of akin to these micro neighborhoods and cities, you know, similar to Europe. It has a sustainability aspect as well. And so when we look to mixed use, we're really looking toward retail-led mixed use, and we're looking to create a merchandising mix in which, you know, people want to go to 3 or 4 times a week, right? So you're creating a lot of heavy foot traffic and natural kind of demand that way. And oftentimes these also have, you know, ancillary demand drivers through local communities and a densely populated community as well. And so, you know, the optionality, I think, within those, if somebody's like, all right, well, let's just go over, you know, to this neighborhood because we know we can find something there. And just developing kind of like that demand where, again, folks want to go to 3 or 4 times a week is really what we're looking toward.
And so does that imply kind of their, maybe essential is not the right word, but I mean, are we thinking like grocery anchored mixed use? Is that kind of the right way to think about it? Or what is the merchandise mix in a mixed use project of the future that you're really excited about look like that brings people in on this highly recurring basis?
Yeah, I think it depends obviously on the location, right? And what the local demand drivers are. But ultimately you want, you know, food and bev and entertainment You want some outdoor space, I think is really, really important. How much necessity, I think, is dependent on sort of what's surrounding you, but you don't necessarily need to control the necessity right there. So necessity is great for like grocery and neighborhood centers because people do drive there, right? If you're driving to the grocery, if you're going to the grocery store, you're really driving there. We're trying to more create walkable communities that can kind of create a flywheel of demand and coexist within one another. So retail, I would say, you know, shopping, I want a little bit of apparel. Food and bev is really, really important. I think, again, if we think about just like a modernized society, I think food and bev is going to become increasingly important. Food is becoming like a very distinct aspect of American culture. And then, of course, you know, having some sort of fitness is important too, because I think more and more we're becoming healthier and more active, which is great. And so you're seeing like all of these cool, you know, niche little sort of gyms popping up that have really gained in popularity. And not only that, they tend to cater to the demographic that's going to support retail spend locally.
So just from a practical perspective, Nuveen's huge. How do you get access to mixed use? Are you investing equity in building projects yourself? Are you acquiring platforms? Are you working through local operators? Like, what is that? What does that look like to get exposure at scale to a sector that you have conviction in?
Yeah, it's kind of all in the above. So I would say, you know, outside of mixed use, we do invest in operating businesses where we have high conviction for some of the more niche sectors. So that would be storage, that would be, you know, medical office, things like that, where we can get better access by finding strategic partners and having direct ownership of those partners versus building it out organically. In the case of mixed use, yes, we are developing ourselves, albeit with local partners. We're doing a project here in Charlotte. I say here in Charlotte because that's where I live. Hi, everyone, Charlotte. It's called Commonwealth. It's on Pecan and Central. It's in Plaza Midwood. Really cool neighborhood. Obviously, Charlotte has 100 people moving to the city every day. It's really growing fairly rapidly. And this is going to be an incredible project. It's a parcel of land, you know, that was owned by the same owner for like 100 years, right? Plus same family ownership. And it incorporates historic buildings as well. And so I think keeping up with the, I think, local aesthetic of the community and history of the community is also really important to maintaining viability. You don't want all national tenants. You want some local, you know, cool, unique tenants in there as well to kind of create a draw. And so, yeah, Brandon, I would just say like it depends on the project, but most of the time we try and control it directly.
Got it. And then on the retail topic, I know, you know, a lot of people think about retail, they think about e-commerce, they think about the shift away from bricks and mortar. What's your kind of point of view on how the continued momentum in e-commerce is impacting kind of the bricks and mortar of retail?
Yeah, I think, look, 80% of all retail sales still involve a physical store, right? And so we look at e-commerce, was it a disruptor? 100%. Will it continue to be a disruptor? Absolutely. That is leveling off though. And just because, you know, even if e-commerce grows to be 20% of total consumer spending, which would be a lot of growth from a dollar perspective, you still have 80%, right? That is not e-commerce. And so I think because of how quickly it developed and kind of grew in a very short period of time, the disruption factor was obviously a lot deeper, a lot sharper than it otherwise would have been if it was just like a slow growth. However, you can't ignore the fact that, you know, retail, I think in and of itself, is still a huge part of consumer spending. And if you look at how retail's been repositioned, what's really been impacted is, you know, your larger malls, right? Large malls, 80s, 90s, even early 2000s had a regional draw. People would drive 90 miles to go shopping for the day. People don't need to do that anymore because of e-commerce, right? That's just kind of like time wasted in your car. However, I can tell you, and this is anecdotal, I look at my kids a lot. When my kids want something, they want me to drive them to the local mall, which is, you know, an outdoor lifestyle center that they love to go to with their friends. So where certain consumers find delivery convenient, there's another set of consumers, you know, younger populations that have grown up in the delivery environment. E-commerce is not an interesting or new thing or new concept to them. And their idea of getting things conveniently is, hey, mom, drive me there. Or I'm going to drive there. I'm going to get what I want right now, today. And I think that's just going to increase the instant gratification portion of our society, which anyone, I think, who has children would agree to that. And so that, I think, is supportive as well. And also, supply for retail centers has been really, really incredibly limited. So within the last 5 years, really, the stat is 130 million square feet of retail has been converted to other uses. And so you've had really, really limited ongoing supply, limited plan going forward. And then not only that, on top of it, you've had a lot of repositioning of old retail centers. So I think that going forward, that's setting retail up really, really well. And where we needed to shift from a supply-demand perspective, we have.
I'm only smiling because of your comment about immediate gratification. Just yesterday, I got in the car to drive 40 minutes to pick up a new e-bike for our family because it was already assembled and I could get it today versus putting in the order, getting it 3 or 4 days from now. But yesterday was the day, so off I went. So I can totally relate to the need for immediate gratification. We only have a few minutes left. Very quickly, I think the corollary here to retail and kind of what we've seen in e-commerce is in some ways industrial, right? There's been a really big uptick in industrial. And I know this is a sector you're focused on. How do you think about industrial as a sector? And then what are kind of the components of it that you like and you're focused on? And if there are any subcomponents of it that you don't like or you're not focused on, what are those?
Yeah, I think, you know, we still have high conviction in industrial. You know, I think rent growth is moderating. We are dealing with, you know, some supply deliveries that are outsized in certain markets. However, if you look at the go-forward pipeline of new supply and new starts and new construction, it really starts to fall off, right? And that's for a number of reasons. One, obviously, construction financing has not been easy to access over the last 24 months. Two, you know, labor has not been easy to access. And then, you know, three, programmatic capital that oftentimes these developers rely on from their equity partners has also dried up over the last 24 months. So that, I think, overall, where supply was the concern, you know, 4 years ago, is really kind of mitigating a lot of that supply concern going forward. However, it's market dependent. It's type dependent. I'll just caveat it with that. And I will say also, as you look, you know, across just from a national perspective, in the US, the top 50 markets, 95% of them are below their historic vacancies, right? You look at Southern California, Inland Empire, incredibly tight market still. And so while rent growth will moderate off of its recent highs, it will still be really strong from a historical perspective. Where we focus is really kind of, you know, we look across the board, but really our bread and butter and our focus over the last 5 years has been in last mile. We think that it's really important and kind of the driver of, you know, if you look at kind of omni-channel and network and the continuum of accessing goods and getting goods ultimately to your end user, last mile is, you know, the beneficiary of that. And so that's really kind of where we focused. And going forward, it will continue to be, I think, a predominant focus as a lot of what we're looking for is also in the most densely populated, sort of the best markets, you know, so to speak, as a result. And so industrial and types and, you know, Clear Heights and robotics and all of these things, ultimately, location and access to consumers can make up for a lot of that. So that's kind of really where we have and will be focused on going forward.
Awesome. Well, we could go on for days probably talking about the markets. So as we wrap, I guess, Is there kind of one thing that we haven't yet talked about that you're particularly excited about from a sector focus? Just to, we don't need to go into detail on it, but like one thing just to pique our interest, maybe we can dig in a little bit more or watch more closely in the headlines over the next kind of 18 to 24 months that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I would just, you know, from a sector's perspective, I would just like briefly go back to what I mentioned. You know, if you haven't looked at OpenAI's release of Sora on YouTube, do it. It's pretty astounding. And so just keeping an eye on those kind of technologies and within physical real estate, what can be impacted by the latest and greatest is really, really important. So I would keep an eye on studios over the next 24 months.
Okay. Well, there you go. On that, if anybody wants to learn more about Nuveen, what's the best way for them to do that or to kind of learn more about your background or get in contact with you?
Oh, well, Google. you can search up Nuveen. You can search me up. You know, I think we all know you can find really anything you want on the internet. So we have all kinds of publications, our latest research, a lot of updates that we, you know, put a lot of effort into. Our CIO for all of Nuveen, Sarah Malik, who you probably often see on Bloomberg or CNBC on broadcast, she does a CIO weekly that's published externally through our internet. And so I think that's really, really interesting just to get a macro perspective, not necessarily a real estate perspective, but a macro perspective on markets generally as well.
Awesome. Well, Carly, it's been really great chatting today. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.